Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
A couple of months ago, I went to a short film festival in Cairo. I'm always just blown away by the creativity and talent of my generation, so I stuck around after for the director's Q&A. One film in particular was completely silent, and it was subtitled. The subtitles reflected the dialogue, both internal and external. Subtitles were actually the most intriguing part. They were in a font used almost exclusively for the printing of the Quran, at least to my knowledge, and they were complete with the punctuation associated with the printing of the Quran, in particular the set of brackets that divides the different Quranic verses from each other. So during this Q&A, I raised my hand and asked, what was the significance of using that font? The director, whose eyes I would describe as either listless or self-satisfied, said that his film was experimental and that the font reflected this, and that was the end of the matter. The audience, who knew the significance of this font, raised a chorus in disagreement, and a conversation broke out between us, leaving the director forgotten. Such is the importance of script. And today we're talking to someone who charts the transition of Arabic script from written to digital, taking a very, very long lens. My name is Ene Mansour, or Nadira, and welcome to New Books and Middle East Studies, part of the New Books Network. Today, my guest is J.R. Osborne, who is an assistant professor at Georgetown University in the Communication, Culture, and Technology Program, or CCT. He is co-director of CCT's Technology Design Studio. He's also a self-described experimentalist of communication. His work explores media history, design, semiotics, communication technologies, and aesthetics with a regional focus of the Middle East and Africa. His research informs his teaching of media production and graphic design. He uses the history of technology to inspire students to imagine new ways to apply digital technology. He has a PhD in communications and a certificate in ethnographic film from the University of California, San Diego. He has extensive curatorial experience and has worked on many film projects. He's also the author of a book, the subject of today's interview, Letters of Light, Arabic Script in Calligraphy, Print, and Digital Design, out 2017 from Harvard University Press. Welcome to the podcast, JR.
Thank you. Yeah, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
No, of course. I absolutely have to express how much I love the book. I think it's such a great... I think anyone who has anything to do with Arabic should read this and just appreciate how layered the history is. So congratulations on the book. It's an achievement.
Thank you.
So I mentioned your extensive curatorial experience. You have a very, you have the background of both a practitioner and someone who studies this in theory. So what's your intellectual history? How did this particular book project come about?
Well, there's kind of two answers to that. I guess there's the personal answer and the academic answer. Generally, I am a practitioner. We're all practitioners of communication in our own regard. We're communicating every day. And I think one of the great things about studying the history of communication is to inspire us or to get us to reflect on the ways we communicate, ways we used to communicate, maybe ways we can communicate again in the future. And so this book in particular, as I said, had a personal history and an academic history. The personal one began shortly after I graduated from my undergraduate, and I was in Istanbul teaching English. And Istanbul's a fantastic city because it's layered with history. And I would walk around the city and I'd see, you know, there's Greek inscriptions. There's a bunch of course, Arabic inscriptions in Arabic script from the Ottoman era. And I would ask the local Turks, unable to you know, decipher them myself at this time, what they meant. And it took me a little while to realize that the citizens of Istanbul, the modern day residents, because Turkey had switched to the Latin alphabet, also didn't couldn't read the Arabic inscriptions. But yet those inscriptions, like the Greek inscriptions that are older than them, remained meaningful, right? They could be read even though they couldn't necessarily be understood linguistically. And that really fascinated me, to thinking of language as a visual marker, how it operates visually different from spoken language. So that was kind of in my mind for a number of years. When I went back to graduate school, I knew I wanted to study visual communication, but I didn't know exactly where it went or what direction it was going. And so that brings me to the kind of the academic reason for writing Letters of Light. And in that regard, when I started studying history of communication, we read about the printing revolution, about the rise of digital computing, all of these technological revolutions. And they're often, they kind of have a very long unified history that is European and American centric. And so what I wanted to do in Letters of Light was look at an equally long history, you know, from the 10th century up to the 20th century, but switch the lens to a non-Latin script, Arabic, which is the one I was familiar with, and look at these same moments of transition. How did Arabic script go from manuscript to print? How did Arabic go from print to digital? And as soon as you switch the lens to a new script, you get a whole slew of different problems, and some problems that repeat themselves. And you also get a different way of looking at the history of communication, both what we've taken for granted, I think, looking kind of only at Western communication, as well as the challenges of spreading that kind of technological systems to other parts of the world.
What I want to emphasize now is that the book is about Arabic script. It's not about Arabic per se, because Arabic script is, as you pointed out just now, it's actually used for many languages that aren't specifically Arabic. So Swahili is an example, Ottoman Turkish is an example, Urdu is an example, and there are many, many more. So this is a very universal and global story in many senses of the word. And then the problems that you just laid out, Arabic script isn't quite like English script, where there are only lower and uppercase variations of the 26 letters, in addition to punctuation. So when you're laying this out on a printing press, on a keyboard, you have, or trying to build code around this, you have to consider the fact that in Arabic script, there are four forms of each of the 28 letters. So there's the isolated form, there's the initial form, so the form the letter takes when it's the beginning of a word, the medial form, or the form it takes when it's in the middle of the word, and then the final form. And then there are special characters for different letters when they combine. And then there's the tashkil, which are the vowel sounds, because Arabic doesn't have an inherent set of vowels amongst those 28 letters. And then there's the question of where the primary line is, so where the letters are written. Are they written on a line? In English, we write on a line, and some things go below the line, like a G, a lowercase G. But in Arabic, things just sort of go all over the place. All over the place, it's not very fair, but they go above and below the line to quite a large degree, perhaps more so than English. So I guess I'm trying to get at what is essential to understanding Arabic script for those who have never had the pleasure of interacting with it before?
Well, yes, Arabic is, as you mentioned, it's incredibly wide used script. I think it is important, as you noted, for us to remember that scripts and languages aren't hermetically sealed, right? That Arabic script is used for all sorts of languages that aren't Arabic, just like Latin script and the letters we use in the English alphabet are used for other languages. And also that those visual systems can change, Turkey being a prime example of that, switching from Arabic script in the Ottoman era to Latin script in the modern era. And one thing about Arabic that you point out is that it's a very vibrant collection of different types of marks. It's not just the letters. There's also the tashkil that dance around the base letters. There's even, as you mentioned in your opening, you know, punctuation is very important in these types of specific types of brackets and marks that kind of indicate Quranic verses or special passages in religious settings and et cetera. I think for those unfamiliar with it, there are two important things to remember or to be aware of when considering Arabic script and its relation with technology. And one is that it's necessarily cursive, that the letters connect to each other one after the other. Not every letter, there are rules that some which connect and some don't. But this means that you have a continuous line rather than distinct characters. Distinct characters such as, you know, the letter A, the letter B, the letter C in Latin script being all by themselves. And I think this is very unique. This idea, as you said, that we often hear then Arabic has isolated initial, medial, and final forms, I would say is actually a technological analysis of Arabic already to get Arabic into a printed mode where you can slide these letters together and maintain the semblance of a cursive script. For calligraphic practice and scribal practice, there's no such thing as a medial form of an Arabic letter in the wild, right? A medial form is in the middle of two other letters. So to write that, you have to have something before it and something after it. And calligraphers in practicing the cursive structure actually didn't study these four different forms of Arabic script. They studied all the connections. How do you connect the letter ba to letter the jim class? How do you connect it to the sin class? How do you connect ba to the ha or sad? So they would work on the connections between the letters rather than thinking of it as you know, isolated initial, medial, final. So I think one is this idea that it's cursive. The other thing that results from that is that Arabic script is multi-layered. It's spatial. There's the baseline of letters that are connected, the rasam, which then get kind of specified by nukta being placed above and below them. And then, as you mentioned, there's the tashkil, which also dance above and below the line. And then in cases, especially for the Quran, there's a whole collection of other more specified markers that indicate pronunciation, cantillation, various other traits. So I think for someone less familiar with Arabic, these are the things to remember to notice, that it connects necessarily, and this is an essential part of the script, that to break up the letters would alter the flow of the script, and that it organizes itself not just in a single line, but as a spatial composition. That it isn't just a line of one letter after another. It is characters that are placed in spatial relation. Some characters have to go above others. Some go below, and it uses grading space as a two-dimensional space. Hopefully for those less familiar with Arabic, I don't know how well I do this in the book, but I do my best to describe some of these general characteristics. As I said, the book is not only directed towards those familiar with Arabic, but also those interested in the history of communication. And I hopefully do a job of explaining some of these differences, not in order that the reader needs to understand specifically how Arabic script, but how these differences then influence the way writing interacts with different technologies as the history unfolds.
So I do want to note that you're also part of this growing field of people who deal with Arabic script, there's this wave of scholarship, basically, of people who look at script and printing from an art history perspective or from a practitioner's perspective. There are new studies in terms of the history of paper as well and different forms of paper design. So riding on this wave recently, there was a blogger known as the Digital Orientalist mentioned, and the author of a recent monograph, Titus Nemeth, they exchanged views more or less. I'm really not sure of the direction of these views or whether or not they're it's unidirectional or not, such as the nature of the internet. But there was this conversation about the aesthetic of Arabic print. So I mean, part of this conversation was, it just hinged around the point that, to put it very basically, that 19th century Arabic print, which is basically the century when Arabic printing takes hold and when books are printed in Arabic for the first time using printing presses or lithographic presses, that print, particularly of printing presses, not necessarily lithographic texts, that those were ugly. So my question to you is, should what we read be pretty? Is that an essential aspect of how we communicate?
Well, I would maybe reframe the question a little bit and say that what we read should be communicative. And we should communicate in as many channels as we can to try to present the specific meaning we're aiming for. And in this regard, I think the focus on aesthetics is whether it's pretty or not pretty takes away from that communicative reading of saying that the way things look are themselves, apart from what they're saying, communicating something. Again, your opening story about the subtitles shows this, that it was the appearance of the font and specifically these kind of bracketed characters that were communicating something, apart from whether or not you thought that font was pretty or beautiful. And so that discussion, I think the way to go at this is, rather than to have an ideal of beautiful script versus practical script, but to reinvestigate the way that changing the image of script, the way that different styles of script, the way that different appearances of script, different colors of script, different materials that they're written on can communicate in different ways. One way to think about this as well. What's so interesting about that debate, of course, is that they're saying, well, you know, printed Arabic script was ugly. It just was information. It couldn't communicate, couldn't compare to the beauty of manuscript design and calligraphic script, and that's much easier to read. But yet this entire debate, as you pointed out, is on the Digital Orientalist's blog. It's being conducted on a digital platform, right? So the comparisons are actually showing digital images of printed material and manuscript material, right? Which demonstrates that digital technology itself can actually can represent both of these, right? The question is, what gets coded and how does it get coded? And I would say that's a second thing we could take from this debate, is that this discussion of pretty versus text, information versus aesthetics, is something that we've tended to divide, partially because of the technologies we use, that images were taken out of text in movable type printing and illustrations were something separate from the textual component. Now we have different file extensions for digital images versus text files. And we tend to think of images, whether they're illustrations or digital images, that's the realm of aesthetics and prettiness. And we tend to think of text as being just a string of information. And one of the things that this debate gets us back to is to say, those are two sides of the same coin, right? Written text is always visual. There's always some aesthetic component that's communicating. And that, you know, what we think of as images themselves are written in many ways, right? They're designing space. So I don't know if I answered the question on whether it should be pretty, but I think a way to go around that question is to consider how we are communicating, not only with the letters and characters we choose, but also the way those letters are dressed says a lot about what the message is.
I completely agree. And I don't want to necessarily speak negatively of other disciplines, but I am speaking as a historian and someone who uses early printed materials. And I just find them so refreshingly experimental, and they're trying out new fonts for headings from time to time. They're looking at how they can use space more economically. I mean, that's another consideration, is when you're printing something, you're using a resource that costs quite a lot of money, as is with paper. But we need to take that into consideration. And then also the fact that, you know, certain things were meant, we're trying to draw on the calligraphic tradition to communicate certain things to readers as well. It's a very muddled soup, so to speak. And I think to think about whether or not it's aesthetically pretty forgets that there are just so many other things that readers were taking into consideration. So one thing I love, yes?
Yeah, well, I was exactly. And I, you know, just to give a few examples, that readers of, when we think of now calligraphy as verse printed, calligraphy tends to kind of collapse all manuscript to kind of beautiful writing, right? And then we get this idea, well, this is much prettier than printed versions or digital versions. But when we begin to look at scribal traditions, and I think this is true for many scribal traditions, and especially true in the Arabic scribal tradition, and especially the Ottoman practice, is that styles of script communicated very specific things. There are certain styles that were only used for the Quran. There were certain styles of script that were used, Diwani, that was used primarily and exclusively for pronouncements of the Ottoman port. There are other styles that communicated the Persian influenced poetry, you know, the what's now known as the Taliq or Farsi script. So these different scripts, the genre of them, or the appearance of them, signified genres in very useful and communicative ways. One of the examples I give my students, if I'm trying to explain this, is I say that currently we have newspapers and they're organized spatially, right? We have the sports page, we have the entertainment pages, we have the business pages, the front page, etc. But imagine if, rather than organizing things spatially, we had all the news kind of mixed together, but we differentiated it by font. So sports was in Helvetica, and maybe entertainment was, you know, Comic Sans, and business was written in Palatino, a Times New Roman. And then if we scan the page and I wanted to know, for example, who won the World Cup, I could search for Helvetica Bold and that would be it. Right. And so and that's a very different way of organizing information, but is equally effective. And I think that's a lot of what was happening in the scribal practice, is using styles of script to indicate genres, to classify and order the textual information, that you can scroll through manuscripts. And by depending on the script, you get a sense of where it's from, what it might be talking about, who may have issued it, and what role it was playing in society.
Actually, it's funny you say that. It's exactly the same process I go through when I look at a newspaper, because I mostly work on newspapers. And what you end up having, especially with newspapers that are sort of trying to get their bearings, is a lot of experimentation of like, well, should this be in a different font? And the largest, I think the most common binary is that there's a different font for ads, and there's a different font for sort of the main text. But another thing I've been finding, and I mentioned those Quranic brackets, is that for ethical literature, which you get a lot of newspapers sort of in the form of, I think the best way to describe it to an English reader, English-speaking reader, primarily English-speaking reader, is it's similar to editorials. And a lot of this uses those brackets. I talked about the Quranic brackets, which I find really interesting. And it's very indicative of a certain time in printing. And I mean, and you also mentioned about the book, and this is what I love about the book, is you're very good at drawing on examples that the reader would know. So you very much talk about sort of the Times New Roman of the Islam or the Arabic speaking, the Arabic script world, which we'll get to in a bit. And you have these little terms to phrases that make it very communicable to someone. And as you mentioned this before, someone who's not familiar with Arabic scripts, who comes from either communication studies or who's a general audience reader and not strictly an academic. And another way you accomplish this is you speak so lovingly of the Arabic script, and you've done this already several times. You speak about sort of the tashkil or the hurufi for the letters dancing on the medial line. And then, of course, the book is titled Letters of Light. And I was wondering if you could sort of spoil me with what exactly inspired that title, Letters of Light?
The title is, it's a little bit of a, both of a pun, but it also, it's meant to encompass the scope of the book. I don't know, in talking with people, I don't know if that's always communicated or understood. But the book, as I said, it's a very long duration history, and it covers 10 centuries, beginning from the 10th century with the formation of proportion script Al-Khat al-Mansub, and goes up until the 20th and beginning of the 21st century with Arabic script on computers and how Arabic interacts with the Unicode digital encoding standard. So it's a very long, long history. And one of the things I wanted to point out with Letters of Light is that letters have always had this sense of pre-trained text. They are illuminating, right? You read something and we say that it is illuminating. The idea of the Enlightenment in Europe was the idea that we are starting to lighten our knowledge. In Arabic specifically, letters themselves are understood or have the connotations of having a divine light as well, that these are the letters, especially the Quran, through which the light of Allah shines. So there's that metaphorical aspect that letters, you know, project light. And if you go then skip forward 10 centuries now to the 21st century, when we are dealing with digital devices, when we are looking at our computer screens and our screens on our mobile phones, we are now to the point where the letters themselves actually are composed of light, right? I'm not looking at printed ink on paper when I read on a computer screen. I am actually having light shown at me, that my letters are now physically and materially composed of light. So I wanted to bring those two ideas of light together, the kind of that letters are enlightening, but now in our digital age, letters have become made of light.
No, I really enjoyed that. I thought that tied it together very well. And I think it's a very risky decision to cover over 10 centuries. But you did it very well. And I think you did it in a way that I think you made great choices in terms of narrowing your focus. And one of them is this focus on Al-Khat al-Mansub, which you mentioned just now. And I was wondering if you could break it down a little further to us, as well as the idea of nasakh.
Yeah, so Al-Khat al-Mansub, or proportion script, was a system that was developed around the 10th century. It's attributed to Vizier Ibn Mukhla. Whether he specified everything or not, there's a lot of debate. But it is a system of determining the script based upon proportions. So starting with the nukta, placing, which is the note or the point of placing the reed pen to paper, gives you a point. Then you stack these points on top of each other. You can establish the height of the alif, the first letter in the Arabic alphabet, which is a line segment. So you have the point, then you have the line, and then from that line segment, there's a circle that in which the line segment is the diameter. So now you have point, line, and plane in the circle. And these are three elements that are common in graphic design practice, that are used in graphic design practice in order to design things, point, line, and plane. So what, and we still see some of the ramifications of this in the way we talk about fonts now, right? We talk about fonts, we measure them in point sizes. Right, and so what Al-Khat al-Mansub was, it was a manuscript, a system for manuscript production, in which styles of script receive specific proportions. They received a specific geometry. So something like nasakh, which I occasionally occur to as the Times New Roman of the Arabic world, because it was a general use script. It gets five nukta, tends to be five nukta tall, Toluth is 7, and these different proportions lead to different shaped letters, and as I say, the flow of the line, the dance of the line, has a slightly different appearance. So it's a geometric system to specify styles of script, and then once you can recognize these differences in the styles of script, those scripts become useful, as I said, as classificatory tools of saying this type of script with these proportions will be used for this type of content, this type of script for this type of portion, with these proportions will be used for this other type of content. So it becomes useful in that way as a geometry on one hand, but also then it contributes to this, what we now understand as calligraphic art, because there's now a geometric basis for the drawing of letters, the writing or drawing of letters, and that can be bent or played with as aesthetic form as well, in order to create what we now think of as these really rich calligraphic compositions that are both visual and textual at the same time.
I have this memory that just hit me right now of being taught how to write in Arabic in the first grade. And the notebooks we had were special for, you know, teaching kids script. And they had, as you noted, the dots on the side so that we could see the proportion of the letters. And I remember struggling with it so much because I just could never get my proportions right. And now that I can write a little bit more fluidly as an adult, I mean, I don't know if I write as fluidly as I would hope in any language, but I can sort of see the effects of having had that drilled into me as I write. I don't think it's ever quite proportional, but there is that system that sort of does come down to me. As you speak also, I'm sort of struck by the fact that as I read the book, I really came to think of the script or the multiple scripts that you discuss as characters, but there's another cast of characters, so to speak, and that's the people who create these words, these letters, and form each generation of script. So there are scribes, and then there are printers, and then there are the coders in our current day and age that also form another set of principal characters, so to speak. So how did each generation or each category of character affect the production of Arabic script?
I like the idea of the scripts or the styles of script themselves being characters, and I thank you for saying that, because I tried to play with that also. As I was writing the book, I thought of the letters themselves as my main characters. And what I wanted to do with the characters in the more prosaic sense, as you say, the people who work with these, the scribes, the printers, the coders, those digital designers, is to then see how they use these other characters, the written characters, in relation to the technologies. And having a large historical scope gave me some ability to kind of move back and forth across the time periods. And I do this often, as you mentioned, the Times New Roman of Arabic, Nashq, using terms that we now use to discuss graphic design and writing, and then looking at them in retrospect. One of the chapters I'm very proud of is the end of the second chapter. I talk about Ottoman scribal practice using the terminology and design decisions that are advised for contemporary graphic designers and typographers. Right, first consider the text, then find a font that's appropriate to that text. Consider the ramifications of that font. Decide how it's going to be laid out on the page. How are you going to use different fonts to distinguish different types of elements, as you said, headlines versus captions? And so I use these guidelines, which are often given for contemporary graphic designers, and applied them to the process of scribal production, saying that this is scribal production was doing many of these same types of the same type of work, making these same type of decisions, right? You'd get a text. What is the appropriate style of script in which this script should be written? right? If it's written in there, is there a family or is there a related script that should be used for headings, you know, and for titles? And so again, trying to break down that idea that that it's handwriting and manuscript production wasn't just handwriting. There also were styles that were being used for communicative intent. Kind of more generally, I think what as you go through these different transitions from manuscript to print to digital, and what are these new generations bringing to it, is that it's always useful in communication history to remember that every time we get a new technology, there's a communication revolution, as the phrase goes, is that there's things that are both gained as well as lost. And being able to then remember that or be reminded of what is lost and ask, is there a way we want to regain this again? So printing, for example, was incredibly powerful as a historically, right? For multiplying the number of texts that could be distributed, for giving everyone similar texts that they could read across wide spaces. And the effects of print have been, you know, well documented. But at the same time, what was lost in this case was that ability to, was that scribal variety, that to make typeset in multiple styles of script was incredibly difficult. Movable type tended to standardize text in one style. You know, now that we have digital computing and multiple fonts, we again have the ability to switch between these fonts and use them for communicative purposes, right? Should we? Will we start to do that? Will it become kind of more ingrained or develop the kind of cultural and genre connotations that were present in the Ottoman practice? I don't know, but it's possible for us. And coders are the same way. I think the digital revolution has certainly expanded our ability to communicate visually, both I think in terms of time, both very quickly and also in terms of spatial organization, the way that we can, the facility with which we can bring in images and fonts and overlay them and have them interacting. And so in that sense, it's more open, but it's also can be a little bit more limiting in the sense that I can go through an entire, on my computer, I can scroll through the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of font choices I have and spend an entire, you know, hour deciding, like, is this the perfect font for what I want? Is this the perfect font for what I want? And I think that's very useful, and it's a fun exercise to do for anyone who hasn't done it. Just see how the our writing changes with selected different fonts. But at the same time, then, there's a question of is that the decision to be made, or is that also when we face with so many choices, is that also a distraction? What is the level that we should be making our intervention, right? Should we be having more fonts so we can communicate with them? Should we be looking at how those the coding is actually encoded, the characters, and how the fonts are being designed? Should we promote a different type of software, right, and say that, oh, we should be using design platforms rather than something like Google Docs or Microsoft Word. So I think what we have now is as each new generation comes to Arabic script, it's the question of what are the technologies available to us and what can each of those technologies do and what do they do well and what do they and what do they do not so well? In the hope for me that when we talk about visual and written communication, it's not just one or the other, right? That in our day and age now, there are books that are still physically printed. There are calligraphers and scribes scribing incredibly beautiful pieces. And there's digital communication that's sharing this. And so that we think of all three of these as technologies that can fulfill different communicative roles within our current digital and communicative moment.
Yeah, it's something that just First off, I really appreciate the fact that you talk about what we gain and what we lose, because as a historian, I think about what we, I think in terms of rupture and continuity, but you're both a historian and you're also a communication specialist. So you have this other design aspect to it of what can we, it's a functioning tool. Script is a functioning tool. So you've recast it in a way that I'm going to have to think about for a while. So I really appreciate that. So to take us back another step, back to print, which is my favorite topic, of course, of all the topics that you discuss in your book, or all of the sort of phases in your book. This is a very controversial question in the field of Middle Eastern history, in the field of the history of Arabic or Arabic script. Why did it take so long to get Arabs or Arabic speakers to print regularly, and specifically why the Ottomans didn't print? Because there was the capability to print Arabic before, quote unquote, what many call the Arabic print revolution, which is another very controversial topic. So I'm just throwing like five controversies at you. So forgive me.
Well, this is I love it. That's part of why I wrote the book as I did. One of the reasons I wanted to take such a long historical lens, again, is that when we don't expand it, we tend to take the models of communication history we have, which, as I mentioned, are often drawn from European and American contexts, and then apply them to other cultural contexts, right? So we hear these, I think there's a few examples of this with looking at Arabic script and Arabic Islamic culture, right? We hear that there was a ban of images in Islam, and therefore calligraphy developed as an art form. And that's a contention that's not really held up. It's a much more nuanced discussion to be going in there. And then we hear again that, you know, printing was had such drastic effects in Europe. So it wasn't applied in the Middle East or adopted for Arabic or by the Ottomans. So we're always asking if these types of that type of intellectual question is why it wasn't the Middle East like Europe, right? Why? And I think a better way or a better model for intercultural dialogue is to look and say, this is a tradition that does something very different from us. What can we learn from that tradition, right? That here's a tradition that combines imagery and text in a beautiful aesthetic and artistic ways, right? That there's something we can learn there, that both text and drawings are both, and figurative imagery are both visual compositions, right? They're both on the same plane. And I think the same question of asking why it took Arabic or why Arabic took so long to get to print, we can ask, well, why not to think that the Ottomans were slow in adopting print, but asking what were they doing instead, right? I mean, Arabic was printed fairly quickly. Within 100 years of Gutenberg, there were styles of movable type in Arabic that mimicked cursive script for all, adequately enough, right? That mimicked Arabic script. And to ask why it took so long for the Ottomans, I'd like to suggest kind of flipping that on its head. And I'll start again with another analogy, kind of common and current analogy, and then I'll work backwards from there. Is that, you know, for 15 years now, maybe even 20 years, if I wanted the latest Hollywood blockbuster on DVD in many parts of the world, right, in Nairobi or someplace in parts of Southeast Asia, I could go down to the corner and I could buy a copy of this, right? On DVD. Those are often, you know, referred to as pirated copies. If I wanted to get that same Hollywood blockbuster here in the US, I would have to wait a good number of months before it was released through official channels. I couldn't get it the same week it was released in the movie theater. And that's not a result of the technology. The digital technology is perfectly capable of copying and distributing these movies, you know, instantaneously. That's a result of a certain set of laws, a certain set of certain understanding about marketing of films and the laws that protect that intellectual property, that they roll out in the movie theater, then they play in the movie theater for a while, then they're later released to streaming and DVD. And so it's a question of the textual or information entertainment system in which those products are located rather than the technology themselves. But to make an argument to say, well, I could get a copy in other parts of the world and I can't get a copy in the US, why is the US so anti-digital technology, sounds preposterous. And why it sounds preposterous is because we're not thinking about this in relation to the technology. We're thinking about it in relation to the US kind of, you know, copyright laws and its system, which works and has worked for Hollywood for a number of years. And so hopefully the analogy isn't lost when we now bring it back to the Ottoman period. And I would say that's a similar thing that happened with print. The Ottomans had a very robust scribal system, you know, with multiple styles of script indicating different types of genres, indicating different routes of authority that were read as markers of and the styles of script were read as markers of authority and origin. And it was working very well for the Ottomans, right? It was very similar time period, right in the middle of the 15th century when Gutenberg first printed the Bible, and the Ottoman conquests of Istanbul or Constantinople, which became Istanbul, right? So the Ottomans were ascendant, and they had a textual system which was working very well, which managed the information across their expanding lands, and they didn't necessarily see a reason, I would say, to change that. Europe, in contrast, at this time was in retreat, and there's a lot of studies about early printing succeeding because it was able that there was a number of piracy. There was the ability for printers to escape local regulations, that there wasn't a central authority, and we see all the effects of printing, which we now look at very positively, were fairly disruptive, right? The church came under challenge. There were multiple different vernaculars and centers of intellectual power that were combating each other. Print led to kind of regional wars in this regard. It was an incredibly disruptive technology. And I think the Ottomans may be looking at that and saying, well, we have a system that works. What is the use of us adopting this technology, which seems to have had such a disruptive role in Europe? So that's, I think, part of the story. So the earliest printing in Ottoman lands was in 1495 with the Jewish population, after being expelled from Andalusia, brought some equipment with them and began printing very, very quickly. You know, this is less than 50 years after Gutenberg's experiments with movable type. So in Ottoman Istanbul, there was incredibly vibrant Hebrew printing community. There was incredibly vibrant Armenian printing community. There was a Greek printing community. And so printing was known. It just wasn't adopted by the Ottomans themselves, and it wasn't adopted for Arabic script. So it's a huge, there's a mystery or wonderful historical discussion and debate on why this was the case. And I would say there's two things I would like to add to this discussion. And one would be to say, well, the first is that the Ottomans themselves had a very useful and very robust scribal system, which was serving their needs quite adequately. They were the dominant power at the time. So therefore, I thought from their perspective, there's reasons to preserve that. It didn't seem to be hindering them in terms of information processing or political power. The other thing I would add is that once the Ottomans did begin to print, which was in the 1720s with Ibrahim Mutafarika. At this time, I also wouldn't say it was necessarily delayed printing. True that it's now a few centuries, about almost two to two and a half centuries after Gutenberg began printing, but it's not delayed if you in comparison to other state presses in Europe. We right around the same time is when we get the National Imprimeur National in France with their specifically designed typeface, the Roman du Roi, which was used to identify things that were printed specifically by the state as an answer to this to the problem of readers being unable to distinguish what was being officially authorized by the state and what was coming from other printers around. The beginning of the same period, I think it's 1710 or so, is when the Statute of Anne was adopted in the Great Britain, which is often given as one of the precursors of what's become known now as copyright law. So it was around the early 18th century when print was formalized into a new textual system. And this is the time in which Ottomans then began printing. So in that sense, I would say that they weren't delayed in their adoption of print especially as a state apparatus. They were actually concurrent with Europe's adoption with print as a state apparatus. What they didn't adopt was when print was still in kind of this experimental stage of and hadn't been formalized into a new textual system of legal oversights and intellectual protections, and I think that's really it's useful to think about the technologies then in regard to how they're serving the, in this case, the Ottoman state or European states, rather than just what they're capable of doing, and that's what the DVD example shows us. I think one another thing that could be learned from this is that even when the Ottomans began printing in the 1720s, they were mostly printing secular documents. The first things that were Ottomans began printing in Arabic were maps and then dictionaries, military histories, official histories, geographic tomes, things that weren't available on the manuscript market. Right? The Quran wasn't printed for another 100 years. By Ottoman presses, right? Which then leads us to question, again, these stories of printing that are taken from the European side, where there's such great emphasis is placed upon the printing of the Gutenberg Bible. And we can start to ask, well, why is it that we assume that a religious text should be the first thing printed, right? A religious text is the most sacred document of a tradition. There's reasons to that it should be the last thing printed after all these kind of kinks and the new technology have been ironed out, so that we know that it's going to be represented and presented in a particular way. So I think looking at the Ottoman transition to print helps us re-ask that question of why did it take so long to print, and not ask in a way of why were the Ottomans kind of falling behind Europe, but again in that way of saying at the time, what was it the Ottomans were doing that was in their mind seen as more useful or maybe superior to the European textual system, and that's why, that can give us some answers on why manuscript technologies or manuscript production and scribal production persisted as long as that did. And there's much we can learn from that, if we think about the DVD example in our current age, that as we develop new technologies at an increasingly faster rate, how much of those technologies or how we're using those technologies are we're using them to their full capability, or how much are we kind of constraining some of these new technologies based upon systems that we have grown accustomed to in the past, and it's the systems that we're more beholden to than the technological possibilities.
So we're going to jump forward another sort of phase, so to speak. So you mentioned several points during this conversation, but it's also a pretty big element in the book. There's the precedent of Turkish script reform. So basically Ottoman used to be written in Ottoman Turkish until the beginning of the Turkish Republic, more or less, was always written in Arabic script. And I've been told by multiple Turkish teachers that Arabic was just inappropriate for Ottoman Turkish. This is a huge sort of ideological contention, is that it was just inappropriate. Thus, it was Latin script was used. It was introduced by the first president of the Republic, Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. And that also has many ideological underpinnings. And I've seen multiple attempts at Arabic script reform for the Arabic language. And there was the most recent that I thought was really interesting was a combination of Hebrew and Arabic script involving the corresponding letters, because the letters do correspond through Hebrew and Arabic largely. But I'd say Arabic script reform, and there's one example in the book of unified Arabic, which just struck me as really bizarre, just because it deals with all of the isolated letters. It's been unsuccessful. Is there a specific reason why we haven't exactly been able to reform the script, or there's no need to? I mean, what's your take on this?
Well, I go back again and say that now we tend to think of languages and scripts as two sides of the same coin, hermetically sealed, right? That this is the best script for representing Turkish, and this is the best script for representing English, and this is the best script for representing Arabic. And that wasn't always the case. Arabic has been used for many Arabic script has been used for multiple languages other than Arabic, and for centuries it was used for Turkish and a variety of other languages. And so languages aren't tied always to a specific script, and those scripts can change. This happened in Turkey. It's happened in a number of the former Soviet republics, where they switched their scripts from Turkish scripts that were once written in Arabic, being switched to Cyrillic, and now being switched to Latin. And so the choice of script isn't, it's always, I think, argued in relation to the way it represents the language. But I think there's always other connotations that accompany these scripts. The fact that for the Turks, Latin script aligned them with Europe, gave a sense of modernity, promoted a sense of modernity. It was, I think, equally important as how Latin represented the sounds of Turkish, and it does represent the sounds slightly different than the way Arabic script represents the sounds. But I think another thing to back up again, I think one of the reasons the book, people have asked me this, why there's such a strong focus on Turkey, even though it's dealing ostensibly with Arabic script. And one of the reasons I look at Turkey in the book, and it forms such a big part of the story, is because the Ottomans were, on one hand, in charge of much of the Middle East, politically and administratively, during the early centuries of print, which we discussed. And then also there's this very interesting case that once the Ottomans kind of lost power, modern Turkey switched to another script. So Turkey has this entire trajectory of, on one hand, kind of, again, in the early days of printing, we see it as resisting technology. And then when it becomes modern Turkey borrowing or choosing a new script, partially in line of how well that Latin script dealt with communication technologies at the time. So to kind of contextualize a little bit about Turkish script reform, first, this wasn't a unique thing to Turkey at the time, right? There was a number of scripts and script reform movements being done during the early and mid part of the 20th century for languages of Korean to Chinese. We see in the mid-20th century is when Chinese pinyin kind of develops. There are also attempts to simplify Greek and Hebrew, and as well as simplify Arabic in other parts of the Arabic world. So this was a discussion being had at the time, which I think now isn't as much of a cultural or international discussion on what are the scripts that should be associated with languages. Now, we assume that those are kind of given. One reason I think it succeeded in Turkey is because Turkey enacted this as a national reform. And Turkey then said Latin script is a script that can best represent the Turkish language, and they instituted it as a Turkish reform for modern Turkey. This is much more difficult when we look at Arabic as a language more broadly, because Arabic is a language that, of course, there are various dialectical differences, but is a language, and the script itself are used across a very wide range of countries. So again, even to leave out kind of Iran and Pakistan, where it's used to represent languages like Farsi and Urdu. But even if we just stick to the Arabic case, that in order to do it equally, to have an equally successful script reform of adopting something like Latin would have entailed in many ways, but the coalition of many countries, many of the Arabic-speaking countries, agreeing to come together and all adopt this at the same time. So that was a much more, it would have been a much larger international and multinational project. But again, I think, but that's only part of the story. I think a larger reason on why script reform, at least in the mid-20th century, wasn't adopted for Arabic is because scripts do communicate by the way they look. And for the Turks, modern Turkey, chose Latin script, they wanted to align with Europe. It was very symbolic of Europe and modernity. And for the modern Turks, they saw Arabic script in the Ottoman past as a legacy of the past that had kind of decreased Turkish glory. So they thought, they wanted to align themselves with Europe rather than the Middle East and Arabic script. For Arabic countries at the same time, however, Arabic script was also seen as anti-Turkish. That it was anti-colonial because it was an Arabic script. It was a symbol of former Arabic glory. It was the proper script that was developed with the Arabic language. And in this sense, it had, unlike in Turkey, in many of the Arabic lands, it had a national connotation and a historical connotation as being you know, pre-colonial and anti-colonial. So again, it's the visual qualities of the script and the connotations of what the scripts mean that are equally important for these decisions on script reform as they are, as it is just the linguistic arguments that tend to be forwarded by those who want to enact them.
I mentioned earlier that your description, or maybe I mentioned this before the interview, but your description of the switch to digital, we're getting closer to the present, is something I actually remember. And I remember just sort of, and I still to this day, you know, certain word processors can't really deal with Arabic script, but you laid down a very good user's guide to sort of typing in Arabic digitally or creating digital Arabic text. And of course, smartphones have changed everything as well. I remember there was a time when my friends would text me using Latin script to spell out Arabic because there just wasn't the capabilities. And now increasingly more people are typing using Arabic script because a smartphone has made it so much easier to do. But anyway, the book does a very good job at explaining what happens when Arabic script goes digital and the problems, because the system was developed in a sort of Western European American context, an English-speaking context, using Latin-based script. So what happens with Arabic's trajectory in the era of digital script?
The example you gave is a wonderful one. You're right, that now increasingly, and I I really love this fact and celebrate it, that we can have a variety of scripts on all of our devices, right? But even this is fairly new development, right? During the Arab Spring, much of the texting that was happening was in Arabese, was using Latin characters to imply Arabic. And this wasn't some kind of creative, this was, I think, a very creative technical adaptation. But the reason this was done wasn't because the youth were making a comment that, oh, we don't like Arabic script in kind of the Turkish reform sense. It was because the technologies at that time only supported Latin text. And so they had to find a way to use those visual symbols in order to communicate Arabic. So Arabic, again, I think, or non-Latin scripts more broadly, came later to the digital platforms. That if we look back at those kind of straw man arguments of Western communication history that I like to kind of bounce my work off of, you know, there's these key moments. There's the Gutenberg printing of the Bible and what that meant and why didn't the Ottomans do that? And then we get for the digital component, we get the birth of ASCII, the American Standard Code for Information Interchange, which coded Latin letters to specific bits and sequences of bits and bytes. And then that gets expanded to other scripts and other languages. But again, that's a technology that was developed for American English and then gets expanded and adapted to other categories. That ASCII, what it does, it actually remediates the model, I would say, of movable type, where movable type has every single character, every letter is its individual box. And then you slide those boxes, those that type together on a line to get a line of script. And this is very similar to the way that most text rendering works on our computers. It has a code, a digital code. It looks that up. It gets a little picture, and then it puts it in line. Then it gets the next code, and it slides those pictures in line, so that it spells a word, right? That, for example, my name, it would get the picture for O, then S, then B, then O, then R, then N, and all together, that would form the word, my name, Osborne. So this is, that's very similar to how movable type worked. And then if we say, well, Arabic lost a lot in its transition to movable type, then it's going to continue to have lost that if this is the model that gets repurposed for digital computing. So these things, some of the things we talked about at the beginning, the ability of the Arabic baseline to kind of dance, to go up and down, the ability for cursive letters to connect vertically from the top and from the bottom, as well as from side to side, all of this is very hard to do with even the text rendering engines we use currently. These problems continue to recirculate in the digital era. Just one example of this for Arabic specifically, and kind of relating it back to Al-Khat al-Mansub. Arabic has standard kind of 28 letters, and a few that people have questions, perhaps a few more. But these letters are broken into very classes: the Ba class, the Sin class, the Jim class, in which the base letter has a similar form. And it has a similar form because of Al-Khat al-Mansub. They have the same geometry. And then they're differentiated by the nokta being placed above or below the line. So ba is the ba class with a nokta below, te with two nokta above, the, etc. Pe, the P sound in Persian, modifying this with three nokta below. So when you get something like Unicode, which is based upon ASCII, it encodes every letter separately. So it includes A, B, C, D for Latin alphabet. For Arabic, it's Alif, Ba, Ta, Tha, Jim, as it, all the various letters. They each get their own code. And then it does the same thing. It looks up the code of the Arabic letter, and it strings them together in a line. This works in order to represent it, but what it means, which is really interesting, is that there's no way within Unicode to determine all of, for example, the letters, the Arabic letters that are in a similar class. There's no marker in Unicode that, for example, that has jim, jim, ha, and ha, all as letters in a similar, the jim class of letters. There's no, there's nothing that indicates ba, ta, and tha as being variations of the ba class with just nokta, nokta differentiations. And the reason that isn't encoded is because in the Latin alphabet, I would say the reason it's not encoded is that the Latin alphabet doesn't have classes of letters. In the Latin alphabet, they are distinct letters, but all the letters are just distinct in their own 26 ways. Even though there are some visual similarities, those aren't seen as semantically relevant or as important. So when you bring in Arabic and just focus on the analytic level is the level of the letter, then you rather than something smaller than the letter, in this case the class of letter and the nokta, you end up losing some semantic information in the way it gets encoded. That you can't search through a text and find, for example, all of the letters of a single class. Without saying, oh, I want to look for this letter and this letter and this letter. I went on a bit of a tangent. I don't know if that was the question about the digital adoption, but I think that's an example of again, thinking of how we get technologies designed for one script or one language. When we apply them to another, we always have to kind of ask, not only what are we gaining by expanding the system, and I think Unicode is fantastic to explain global communication, but also is there something being lost and should we work or consider ways to regain that in today's digital moment?
Yeah, I think that's actually a really great example, and I think that's one of the questions that a lot of people who – it's funny, with different waves of technology, I think people have had different – and you note this in the book, there's this whole conversation about a competition to change the Arabic script in the mid 20th century and what to do with Arabic script. And I think that this hits exactly at that because, I mean, I occasionally just generally think about where we were 15 years ago and where we're going to be in 15 years. And I can't even imagine what technologies are to come. Yeah, it's difficult when also the way you think about these technologies are being developed in certain areas with very different considerations, and there are shifting axes and poles of sort of technological hubs, but there is a shift, but there is a certain hegemony, and as you mentioned, if a system is developed for Latin-based script, it's not going to take into consideration the fact that there are classes as in Arabic. And it's funny, I never actually quite thought of it like that, the fact that there's a jim and a ha and they look the same. I think it's just been so long since I actually sat down and thought about it that way until I encountered your work. So it's funny because as we've gone through this, something that does strike me is that we talked a lot about how technology changes things, but the Arabic script is still very durable. Like you take a manuscript and you take something that I type on my phone, on my smartphone, and they do look, I mean, maybe the font on my smartphone is a little weird, but like they do look to some extent similar. You also do still have those different phases that you talked about, sort of where you add the dots and where you add the vowel sounds, the tashkeen. So what do you think accounts for the, do you think the Arabic script is durable? What accounts for its durability?
Well, I think it's been incredibly durable, just by virtue of its history, and I think there's a few kind of things, at least in studying Arabic. What's so fascinating about it is its durability is shown in the way that it's adapted to so many, not only new technologies but so many different roles. Right, the Arabic script remains one of the few sacred scripts that's still used also on a daily basis for secular and everyday profane purposes. So it's sacred, it's secular, it's been celebrate as an art form. It's also been used as for textual writing, right? So it has religious connotations in the way that it unites the global Islamic community as a symbol of Islam. But at the same time, it has national connotations in the way that it differentiates. For example, the Arab countries from, especially now, Turkey, and the way that styles of Arabic differentiate, for example, the Arabic countries from Iran. So it's been incredibly durable in the sense that it has persisted in all these roles, often at the same time, through variations of in its visual appearance. So I think that's something to learn from in terms of its durability. The other thing is, because it's layered, is that it can express a very wide range of nuance, if that's the right word, that there are, you know, the Arabic can be just the rasm letters, just the rasm and the nukta, the consonants, which is how it often appears. If necessary, the vowels can be added, the tashkil markings for vocalization can be added for those for educational purposes or for other purposes. Then, if necessary, there is mentioned these special characters for Quranic recitation and pronunciation. So there's various layers of specificity that this single script can provide. And that's an incredibly powerful. I think to go back to that discussion between the Digital Orientalist and Titus Namath, I think part of that discussion about the fact that printed Arabic is less beautiful than manuscript Arabic is because scribal Arabic with these various layers can condense so much information in a smaller amount of space, because there can be tashkil marks above and below the line. There can be these other marks. Arabic, but the cursive line can be condensed. So if you look at manuscript and scribal productions, part of, I think, when people say they're more beautiful, is that they're actually, the letters are much tighter together and actually give more information per inch or per centimeter than the printed versions. And so that's what they're commenting on, is that they're saying this is actually, in the same amount of space, it's doing more work, right? That in this, you know, if we wanted to add vocalization, we don't need to increase the space it's taking up. We just need to kind of add little, you know, the fetta and the dhamma around the forms. So you can layer a lot of layers of information within a smaller bit of space. And I think that's a very incredibly powerful visual communication, even now, is in terms of graphic design and interface design, and, you know, the importance of screen space and the questions of resolution of how much information can we fit onto a screen. We can see that Arabic, by layering additional marks over the main characters, had suggestions for doing this much earlier than hundreds of years before computers arrived on the screen. So I think the durability of Arabic is shown in its ability to adapt to so many different uses, whether those are secular, sacred, profane, national, aesthetic, textual, you know, information based, as well as the things it can teach us today about design and the ability of a script to remain, on the one hand, open to these different roles and visually malleable enough that it can perform those multiple roles. That Arabic script can, you know, be used for newspapers without all of the markings and effectively communicate the news of the day. At the same time, that same script with additional markings can be used to render the Quran and preserve the Quran in exact specificity. And so a script that can do both of those, from kind of the general to the specifics, is an incredibly powerful visual tool.
Oh, that's a lovely, it's Again, I love the way you discuss the Arabic script. It is really with, oftentimes, I think what you look for in academic work is work with soul. And I definitely feel like the book has that. It has quite a lot of soul and love and appreciation of the Arabic language, Arabic script. And I really appreciated that. And I really hope that this book is received well amongst both communication specialists. But I also think, like I said, this is really essential reading for anyone who has anything to do, who reads sources in Arabic, who regularly deals with the Arabic script on a frequent basis. So congratulations on the book.
Thank you again.
So to close the interview, what are you currently working on? Sort of, can you give us a little bit of a tease?
We said at the very beginning, I consider myself as equally an experimentalist of communication. I do that a lot with my students here at CCT. I kind of curate shows in our galleries and museums. And so a lot of my own work is trying to introduce these ideas to students and then to see how they can apply them to digital products in interesting ways. So we've been doing, I oversee a lot of kind of experimental design work with my students in which we try to ask what would these historical practices look like in a digital medium. Along that line, I've also been then studying the curatorial practice. I have a book that I'm co-authoring with Benetta Jules Rosette at University of California, San Diego called African Art Reframed, which looks at African art museums and plays a similar role as Letters of Light in kind of looking at having a comparative analysis of what does African art mean in a museum to look back at museum practice very broadly. So on one sense, I'm kind of expanding into kind of museum practice and those types of aesthetics. In terms of Arabic script, I'll be embarking upon with you as well, hopefully, is this our colleague Natalia Soot discovered this memo by Mohammed Nadim, who is one of the judges of the Arabic script reform competition that we had alluded to a few questions back. She discovered this in the Dar al-Kutub archives. It was uncatalogued, and we're now working on a project to transcribe it, translate it, and then to collect a number of critical articles looking at what the Mohammed Nadim's memo has to say about, first of all, the technology of Arabic script, as well as the cultural moment, how that relates to printing in Egypt. And that's an incredibly exciting project because primary documents from the Middle East about the Arabic script reform in this competition are incredibly rare. There are very few studies of the competition that I know of that have looked into the specifics of the documents and internal communications. So that's I'm looking forward to working on that project. It's a wonderful complement to Letters of Light, which Letters of Light gives a very long kind of contextual history of Arabic and how we arrived at the digital moment, and now being able to take those lessons from looking at that long history as a model to go back and study specific primary documents is incredibly exciting. And especially this document by Mohammed Nadim, as I said, who was a judge for the Arabic script reform competition, and will hopefully give us some insight and some answers to the question you asked on why it wasn't as successful in the Arabic world when it had been a success in the Turkish context.
Yeah, I'm really excited about that. It gave me this just wind of this fresh burst of energy. When I was working in Cairo a couple of months ago, I went to the archives at the Language Academy, the Academy of Arabic Language, to do some work on this. And the material I found was really exciting. And the memo itself is just so reflective and tells you so much about how, I mean, I think the categories with which people see themselves is a really useful way of portraying that history. So I'm really excited about this particular project. And I think it'll be, I think also the variety of perspectives that you and Natalia are trying to gather will really result in a fruitful project. So best of luck. I'm really excited to continue working with you.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I think also just looking at a primary document like this to get the terminology that was being used by a printer and in Egypt at this time? How did he talk about these? Because, I mean, one of the things that was really interesting to me in Letters of Light was realizing that coming from a Latin script bias, there's actually a certain dearth of vocabulary we have. There was a lot of discussions with my editors in terms of what how to define what I was talking about, that what does script mean, which usually means like Latin script versus Arabic script versus Hebrew script. And then I was also using script to talk about different types of Arabic script, nashk, you know, talik, diwani. And so we had to specify that terminology, right? Styles of script we use for internal Arabic script, script for larger notational systems. So being able to look at a primary document like this and find out as well as how is the terminology being discussed by practitioners themselves at that time is incredibly useful. And I think could be very useful for communication scholars who are then looking at these things historically as well as in contemporary practice. So yeah, I'm very excited about this.
Yeah, we'll see it hopefully in the next couple of years. Well, anyway, thank you so much for spending this time with me, and best of luck.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. It's my pleasure.